Mad, Mark After Dark, the man that hates everything except the real thing. Coming to you once again, live on the air. Tonight on the program, my continuing interview with Brian Downey, drummer of Thin Lizzy. On New Year's Eve 1973, Eric Bell suddenly left the band and was replaced by Gary Moore to help finish the tour. What was the difference between Gary Moore to Eric Bell playing in the band at that point, and how would you compare working with Bell to Moore and recording with him?
Well, you know, both were great to record with. There was absolutely no problem in recording with either guitar player. I think the difference was we did much more with Eric Bell than we did with Gary Moore. Now, we only did one album with Gary, which is a Black Rose album.
Yeah,
and we did one single called Little Darling. And that was one single for Decca Records after And it's kind of hard to compare because, you know, but I mean, the only thing I can safely say was really, really fantastic, enjoyable to play with both guitar players. And there was very little in between because, I mean, there were great guys in the studio. Eric Bell had some fantastic ideas in the studio. He was a mine of ideas, you know, he was just unbelievable. And Gary was just an incredible technical player, and he came up with some unbelievable solos, and it was just great to play with both of them. But I find it hard to actually compare because, I mean, they were slightly different in their approach to recordings, you know. Eric would be more slow and deliberate, it'd take his time, where Gary would be very quick and, you know, he wanted to get things done very, very, very quickly and out of the way.
After a show in Glasgow, Scotland on February 9th, 1974, Brian Robertson came up to your hotel room and started playing Thin Lizzy songs for you. What was your impression of Brian, and what songs did he play, and did you think he was going to be in Thin Lizzy at that time? This is during...
I had no idea he was going to be in Thin Lizzy, and the reason he came up to the room is because he knew this guy called Charlie McLennan, who became our road manager. In fact, he became one of Phil's best friends. Charlie McLennan was a big fan of Thin Lizzy, and he's from Glasgow, Scotland. And anytime he played up in Scotland, he was always there and thereabouts and backstage and everywhere, and got to know Phil and everybody else very, very well. And we just happened to be playing in Glasgow one night, and he came back backstage and introduced himself and introduced Brian Robertson to me. And, you know, he said, "Where are you staying?" And I said, "I'm staying in blah, blah hotel." I can't remember the name of the hotel offhand.
Okay.
But he said, "You're staying there. That's not far from where I'm staying. I'll see you later, maybe for a drink." And I said, "Yeah, you know, come back and have a drink." You know. So he came back to the hotel after the gig, and he had a guitar with him, you know. And I was in my room, and he just called my room. He said, "Are you still in your room?" I said, "Are you coming down?" I said, "Well, why don't you come up and before we go down for a drink and bring your guitar?" And he said, "Yeah, I'd love to do that." And, you know, because he obviously had a first and second album. And he came up to the room, and he was with his girlfriend. And he just came and sat down, started talking about how good the band, how much he liked the band, how good the band was on the gig. And took his guitar out of his case and started playing songs off the first and second album. And I was just amazed. He was playing some great stuff, you know, like Eric Bell, you know. And I was just completely taken aback that he was so good. Mm-hmm. And then he started jamming on some blues, 12-bar blues tunes that he knew. And I was just amazed. He was so young and so enthusiastic. And I'm a really nice, friendly guy as well, you know. So we just started chatting about music generally. And then we decided to go down to the bar and have a few drinks and just got chatting down there. And never thought that I'd see him again in an audition to Thin Lizzy, you know. I just put it down to a guy that came in and just so happened to like the band and brought his guitar and his girlfriend and started playing in my hotel room. Just unbelievable. But that's what happened in those days. Mm-hmm. And never thought anything of it. And a couple of months later, or maybe a year later, we were looking after Eric Bell and Gary Moore. Decided not to stay. We decided to In fact, it was after John Cannon on the J-Time.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
But anyway, it was around that time when he came in. But I mean, going back to John Cannon on the J, they were the guys that took over from Gary Moore when Gary didn't take up the offer to stay, and they were drafted into the band to do a couple of tours. But they didn't really work out too well. So when Phil decided to break the band up, we both decided to not to break the band up, but to look for new guys. You know, Brian Robertson happened to come down one night to the audition in the country club in West Thompson in London. And I just recognised the guy immediately. And I looked around to Phil, and Phil didn't know who the hell he was, even though he had met him in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And I just said to myself, this is the same guy, it has to be, you know. And I looked at Big Charlie, he gave me a big smile, and I went, is it the same guy? And Big Charlie goes, that's Charlie McLennan. He said, yeah, it's Brian, you know. So I was kind of amazed. So, you know, he strapped on his guitar, plugged in, and he just sounded as good as he sounded in the hotel room.
Yeah.
He sounded phenomenal, he sounded brilliant. And, you know, from the word go, we knew, I knew anyway, that this guy has to join the band. He has to come in and join the band. There's no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
And after he finished after four or five songs, I looked at Phil, and Phil was going, well, who's the next guy? And I'm going, hang on, man, you know, well, what do you think of Brian Robertson? He said, oh, is that his name? Mm-hmm. I said, yeah. He said, oh, yeah, yeah, well, who's the next guy? And I just said, well, there's no more to the guy. So, anyway, I said to Brian Robertson, just hang around for a while, you know, and don't leave, whatever you do. So he went down to the back of the club, and some other guys got up and played. And
well, who else? Who else auditioned for Thin Lizzy besides Scott?
There was one guy, a guy called Cosmo Vinyl, who was a guitar player around that time. He was playing with all these sort of glam rock bands. Another Scottish guy, and that was his nickname, Cosmo Vinyl. I don't remember his real name. But he was really good as well, but not as good as Brian Robertson, but he was there, and there was another guy as well from London. I can't remember who the hell he was. But there was a couple of guys after Brian Robertson that we auditioned, and at the end of the audition, Phil comes up and goes, well, what do you reckon? I said, well, you know, I think Brian Robertson definitely should be given another chance. And he goes, yeah, I think so too. I said, brilliant, you know, great. So there's no problem there with Brian Robertson. I think he got the gig literally that particular audition. Mm-hmm. There was no question of asking him to go again. We kind of knew, and
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think it was the next day he was given the all clear, and you know, to come down and just wait around, because Phil wanted to go for
another guitar player.
He didn't think he wanted to just stay with one guy, you know, because. Mm-hmm. He wanted to be a four-piece band rather than a three-piece band. So we decided to carry on the auditions with Brian Robertson on board. And we carried on. We had more guitar players coming down for a few days. And then suddenly, Scott Gorham turned up with really, really long hair, unbelievably long, and just walked in and, you know, plugged in, and everybody went, wow, you know, this sounds pretty cool as well. So, you know, Phil, again, another case of, well, you know, hang around and don't leave. And we got some other guitar players in there, which didn't sound as good as Scott. At the end of that session, Phil went into the control room, which we had a kind of a tape recording setup going on, and listened back to some of the tapes, and obviously liked Scott, because he came back to me and goes, you know, I think we found the guys here, you know, Scott Gorham sounded pretty good, and I went, yeah, he does.
What was the transition period like when the band changed from a three-piece to dual lead guitarist, and how did you adjust and change your drumming style to fit with the transition?
Yeah, no, the drumming, well, our first album with the four-piece...
It's Nightlife.
Was Nightlife, yeah. Was Nightlife, I think. And what I discovered with two guitar players was the sound was much, much fuller,
mm-hmm.
and which made me kind of psychologically think that I could lay back a little bit playing drums rather than do some really heavy drumming, which I was doing with the three piece.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of laying back a little bit because I found the sound much fuller. There was lots of gaps being filled, you know, which I thought maybe, you know, was okay to lay back a little bit, not push it too hard, and which I did for lots of rehearsals in those days, you know. I kind of laid back, and that kind of comes across a little bit on the Nightlife album.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit laid back, a little bit less urgent than the first three albums with Decca. And again, we were looking for a new record deal. We'd left Decca at that stage, and you know, we were still looking for a deal. And our manager eventually got a deal with Phonogram Records.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we went into the studio to record Nightlife, we didn't really have much live work under our belts. You know, we were still sort of feeling each other out. We weren't sure even at that stage. You know, it was a couple of months after those auditions finished and all the rehearsals finished, and mm-hmm. we were still sort of trying to find our feet as a four-piece band. We were a little bit unsure what was going on. And the guys were a little bit inexperienced. Not saying that took away from their playing, but they were a little bit inexperienced, and that came across, I think, as well on that Nightlife album.
Mm-hmm.
And what we had a little bit of a problem as well in the studio with our engineer, with our producer, Ron Everson, especially with Brian Robertson. I think Brian found him a little bit nearly impossible to work with because he's. His style was a bit gruff and a bit abrasive.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they weren't getting on too well. But I mean, having said that, it got a very good sound in the studio because, you know, it sounds like we're still trying to find our feet, but it sounds like we've got some really good tracks here, you know, even though some of them didn't come off too well.
Yeah.
But, you know, but there were some tracks on there that were pretty good, especially like things like Shalala and
You wrote that,
you know. Yeah, you know, and also like It's Only Money was a good track, and
yeah, It's Only Money could have been on Fighting.
It could have been, you know.
Yeah,
it could have been. So there was some good tracks and some not so good tracks on that album. So, but you know, there was a little bit of tension in the studio, and I think that sort of that took away a little bit from the urgency as well that we could have got in the studio with the song choice.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you know, but there again, you know, as I say, you know, we were still trying to find our feet. We weren't completely comfortable with each other's styles.
Yeah.
That came a little bit later.
Gary Moore and Frankie Miller were guests on Still in Love with You on guitars and vocals. How did this come to be, and how would you compare recording this track to playing it live with Scott and Brian?
Yeah, well, the thing about that track, it's a kind of a strange one because we did a demo with Gary Moore before Gary left.
Mm-hmm.
in the studio in the south of England, in a place called Worthing in the south of England. And it was a little demo studio, and Gary was there playing, and he played a fantastic guitar solo on the original demo. So, Phil. When we got into the main studio, when obviously Gary left at that stage, but with Brian Robertson and Scott Gorham, Phil said, look, you know, I want to keep the guitar solo, or I want to get rid of everything else on this track, Still in Love with You. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he says, we're going to keep the guitar solo from Gary's demo, but you have to overdo the drums, and I'll overdub, you overdub the drums, I overdubbed the bass and the vocals. And I said, that's going to be nearly impossible. He said, no, it's not. He said, we can easily do it if you put a mind to it. Which meant that the overdubs, the drums were new, the bass was new, and the vocals. And Gary Moore's guitar solo was the only original part from the old demo that we had. And Phil incorporated that solo into this new version of Still in Love with You. When it came to the actual recording, Phil did say, he said, you know, I want to keep the drums, I want to keep the guitar and overdub the drums and the bass on the vocals, so which meant keeping Gary Moore's guitar solo from the demo we did. So I just thought this was fascinating. I just couldn't believe he was thinking this way, because we said, look, he said, you know, the guitar solo was just fantastic. We can't let that go. And I did agree with him. There's no doubt the guitar solo was just fantastic. Mm-hmm. And we decided to keep the guitar solo and overdub everything else, and maybe put a little bit of rhythm guitar from Brian Robertson and Scott Gorham on there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the studio version of Still in Love happened, you know. But and Frankie Miller, his voice was also a part of that demo, as far as I know. He wanted to keep Frankie Miller's voice. Now, I can't be sure here. I kind of, for years, I often thought maybe Frankie Miller was at the demo studio in Worthing. But yet, looking back, I couldn't be 100% sure whether Frankie Miller came to the demo studio or whether he came to the main studio when we were recording Nightlife. I can't be sure about that. But he's on there anyway. And I'm not sure which studio that particular... his voice was recorded in, you know. But either way, Frankie Miller sounds just brilliant on the album, you know, mm-hmm. on the track. And it came across really, really, really well. The Phil's vocals as well. Both of them complement each other lovely, you know. So that's how that happened. But when we came to, you know, release the record, our management had to say that the guitar solo was Brian Robertson.
Oh yeah.
No, I've no reason. I've no idea why they thought that, but that's the case, you know. So a lot of people thought that particular solo was Brian Robertson, and it was really Gary Moore. So, you know.
So then, Thin Lizzy toured with BTO and Bob Seger in early '75. Did the friendship that developed from that tour result in Thin Lizzy doing a cover of Bob Seger's Rosalie?
Yeah, it did. And, you know, I mean, that was the first American tour. It was the first time I was ever in America. You know, we were depending on Scott Gorham to kind of fill us in on what it was like in America. But when we got there, we discovered that, yeah, okay, Scott. But it was just much, much better than he said. You know, it's just a great fit into in America, playing American soul. And especially playing with Bob Seger and BTO. But Bob Seger, we heard of Bob before we left for the tour, and, you know, everybody was really sort of looking forward to seeing Bob Seger and playing with Bob. BTO we knew from, you know, You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, from the single, and, you know, everybody was, you know, looking forward to that. But I think mainly we're looking forward to seeing Bob Seger and Silver Bullet Band. So we got there, you know, everything was much, much larger than life, and the auditoriums were massive compared to the places we were playing in the UK. And, you know, some of the dates were just spectacularly good, because, I mean, the PA systems were much, much louder. Everything was huge compared to what we were used to. And, you know, we just got on there and just tried our best to be down well. Even though we were completely new to the circuit, I think we did quite well with some of BTL's fans, because we didn't get booed off. Mm-hmm. we kind of held our own.
Yeah.
But Bob Seger, his band were just spectacularly good. They were just fantastic. And I personally thought they were better than BTO, but, you know, but they weren't obviously gone down as well as BTO, but they were really playing much better. I thought they were better players, but they had a couple of songs, and one of them was Rosalie, which to us was just one of the best songs we ever heard, you know, ever. It sounded so good on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And Rosalie was just a really fantastic song to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Phil was going, you know, we have to do something here with Rosalie. It sounds so good. I said, yeah, we should do it, maybe do it live on stage when we go back to England, and we'll he said, no, he says, I'd like to do it now. And I said, man, we can't do it. That's two bands playing, you know, Rosalie and the same. He said, yeah, you're right, you know. So we waited till we got back to England, and we just rehearsed it for a few times and you know, maybe speed it up a little bit compared to Bob Seger's version, and just put a little stamp on it, you know, just to make it more Lizzie-like.
So you released Fighting in September 75. The track Suicide was originally performed with Eric Bell and recorded live for a BBC broadcast from July 1973.
Yeah.
How were the two versions different from one another? The Gorm Robertson version to the Bell version?
A good question. I think the original version with Eric Bell was more of a bluesy kind of sound, because I think Eric was using a bottleneck on the actual original Suicide. Much slower. The lyrics were different. Phil didn't have a fully developed lyrics at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And also, although we kept the shuffle beat, it was much more deliberate. It was more rather than on the right cymbal, it was on the hi hat. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a little bit more, it was slower, more bottleneck, more bluesy, and filled with slightly different lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of evolved over time after Eric left, and it became fully fledged when we went into that studio and recorded it in a Olympic with Brian Robertson and Scott. And it took us a while to get up to that standard, because it was one of our favourite tunes to do live before we recorded it. But the live version was more urgent, you know, it was more upfront, where Eric Bell was more laid back.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the main difference.
Okay.
You know.
On Jailbreak, which was released in 76, like we had just talked about, what made the band to want to originally release Running Back as the first single instead of The Boys Are Back?
Yeah, I think that was another idea that Phil had. Maybe let's release this because it sounds commercial.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he did say to a couple of people in the record company, and in fact, I was there one day when somebody turned around and said, well, it is commercial, but there's another couple of tunes on Jailbreak that sounds maybe not as commercial, but sounds more in keeping with what Lizzie should be, you know, chart-wise. And I went, maybe that's the way to go. And he said, how about maybe The Boys Are Back in Town, or even Jailbreak itself? And Phil goes, well, not really, because when I wrote this song, I had the idea in my head, it was going to be a single. And everybody went, yeah, it's definitely a commercial, you know, there's no problem there. But how about doing maybe Jailbreak or The Boys Are Back in Town? And eventually, I think everybody was persuaded, and The Boys Are Back in Town became the favourite of all the record company people
mm-hmm.
who happened to hear it, including people that Phil knew and I knew. You know, people outside the band who listened to the album before it was released. I think everybody, the consensus was, okay, you know, Running Back is a good song, but The Boys Are Back in Town is much better. I think Phil came around to it eventually, you know, although it took him a while, because he had his heart set on releasing Running Back as a single. And I think the management rolled in behind Phil as well, saying that maybe Running Back could have been the you know, more commercial than The Boys Are Back in Town. I'm not 100% sure about that, but I have a feeling that was the case as well.
Wow.
but I think eventually, I think with all the people's opinions, when everybody was sitting down around the table or around whatever, and everybody went, yeah, maybe, you know, Boys Are Back in Town would make a better single. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
that was the case, because Phil eventually came around to it in the end. And we never looked back since.
Well, on September 2nd, 1977, Bad Reputation was released. The album basically featured you, Scott, and Phil. What was it like recording and playing as a three-piece? Even though I know Brian Robertson was on a few tracks, he wasn't on
yeah.
the whole album. What was
yeah.
it like?
Well, you know, we had a great situation going on, because we knew that Tony Visconti wanted to do this album with us, and that was a great feeling to know that we could get out of England, out of the UK, and find any studio we wanted to do this album, and we so happened to find the studio in Canada, in Toronto, and with Tony on board, it was just great. But what made it a little bit strange for me was Brian Robertson wasn't going to play in the whole album, and I just found this a bit off-putting, to say the least. I said it to Brian, to Phil, and he said, "Look, you know, I don't particularly think it's going to be a big obstacle." He said, "We can do it, and maybe get him over to do get Brian over to do some overdubs, you know, and solos, etc." And I said, "Yeah, well, it'd be really great to, just to have the four of us there." And he said, "I don't think that's going to happen because, I mean, the split was there with Phil and Brian Robertson. There was a bit of a animosity and a little bit of whatever happening at the time." So, I mean, I could see Phil's point. And I think Brian Robertson would have been a little bit uncomfortable coming in to do the whole album. So I just left it at that. But it was always in the back of my mind that maybe, you know, we should have had a four-piece here, but that wasn't to be. But having Tony Visconti on board, having a great studio and in Canada and, you know, and all the time in the world to do it, it was just a good feeling anyway. So we just knuckled down and just did it because, I mean, everything fell into place. Our hotel was great. It was a brilliant hotel. We met some great friends there. It was like a home from home in the end, and it wasn't too far from the studio. You know, the drive was only 5 or 6 minutes away. So, you know, and Phil was writing some great songs for that album. We all knew that, and our confidence was sky high. Even though Brian Robertson wasn't around, but Tony Visconti just got a great sound in the studio on that album, and you know, it was, to me, it sounded one of the better albums. Now, you know, okay, as a three-piece, Robert did come in and do his overdubs, and I thought maybe he could have played much more on it. But Scott Gorham, I must say, Scott did a fantastic job on that album. Do most of the guitar work.
Oh, he's great.
You know, it just sounds great to me. It stands up today. You know, most of those albums do, but that one particularly stands up. But Brian came in and he did some great solos. You know, there's no doubt about that. So all over, it was a very very enjoyable album to play on. A different situation. We were outside of the UK, recording in a different country. You know, Tony Visconti there and. What more do you want? And Phil's songwriting and all that was coming across great as well. So overall, yeah, we were very pleased, and it's really a pity we never got back to Canada to do some more stuff because I wanted to do that, and unfortunately, we never got the opportunity in the end, you know, to do it. Unfortunately, that's the way things go.
So recently, a recording was unearthed and released entitled Still Dangerous, live at the Tower Theater in Philadelphia, 1977. How would you compare this performance to the Live and Dangerous album? And what are your recollections of those shows?
Yeah, well, you know, I think, well, Live and Dangerous, for example, you know, over the past couple of years, a lot of people have been saying it's the best live album maybe a rock band ever did, but I can see the point. It's a great live album, and Still Dangerous was recorded around that same time. You know,
yeah.
I think we're on the same tour, if I'm not mistaken, and we were in great form playing. We absolutely no problem there playing live, and we were seriously on top of our gig. You know, I mean, Live and Dangerous recently, again, a lot of people have been saying, well, there's lots of overdubs in there, lots of guitar overdubs.
Yeah, that's what I keep hearing, that there were overdubs, and it sounds like that's the way the band sounded live. I mean,
yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think if people listen to this Still Dangerous album, you'll find that the overdubs weren't that much and weren't that essential. Because as far as I remember it, some of the overdubs are very basic guitar chords, maybe a couple of bass notes, a little bit of vocal, not much vocal. Absolutely no drums were overdubbed at all whatsoever. Not at all. And if you compare it to Stillvengeance, you discover that, you know, if you compare both of them and some of the tracks are similar, you find, you know, there's very few really essential overdubs. Not like some people have been saying the whole album is overdubbed. That's absolute rubbish. Yeah. It's not overdubbed. You know, obviously there is a couple of overdubs, as I just said, on guitar and bass and vocals, but not that much. But I mean, you know, the comparisons between both albums, we're on the same tour. We had very little change in the actual set list, as far as I remember. Maybe a couple of different.
Well, yeah, the Opium Trail is on that, which you. Oh my God, that was great.
Yeah.
I mean,
if you couldn't get on to Live and Dangerous.
Yeah, which wasn't on Live and Dangerous. Opium Trail was on there. I don't remember every track. It is very similar, though.
It is very similar. And, you know, but I mean, generally, we were on the same kind of, same tour, same months maybe, a couple of months in the difference. I'm not really sure. But, you know, I mean, when I heard the actual album first, I said to Scott, you know, I had a tape of a cassette tape that Phil gave me of that particular show from the Tin Bit, I think it was the Tin Bit Biscuit Factory.
The King Biscuit Flower Hour.
The King Biscuit. I had an old tape of that for years and years. And, you know, it always sounded, anytime I played it, sounded a bit weird because it didn't sound up to scratch. And I said, well, you know, it's obviously taken from the soundboard. Never thought anything of it until Scott said to me one day, he said, look, we found these tapes in a lockup in London, you know. And I said, what was it? He said, it's the old King Biscuit stuff we did. I said, I think I have a tape of that. I must fish it out and have a listen again. Oh, he said, no, don't bother. You know, he said, this is a master tape, you know. And I went, oh, great. Well, what's all that? He said, look, I'll make a CD of them. Try and get it to you as quickly as possible, and you know, and the next time you're in London, you know, we'll sit down and have a chat. So I did, you know, I got a CD. It sounded great to me. So we got Brian Jones in to mix it, you know, and I went to London to meet up with Scott. I didn't meet Glenn, unfortunately, he wasn't around, but I met Scott, and he said, look, you know, Glenn is willing to remix it. How do you feel about it? I said, great, you know, no problem. He says, well, you know, there's a couple of tracks on there that we never put on Live and Dangerous, which is going to be on Still Dangerous. I said, great, you know, no problem. And he said, are you willing to come in to mix it? And unfortunately, at the time, I was playing with Gary Moore. I was doing a tour with Gary, and I couldn't get into the studio to do anything with Scott and Glenn John. So I just left it to the guys. So and Glenn did a great job, you know, he did a fantastic job of remixing all the album, you know. Sounds great, you know, and he did a brilliant job. But I mean, just looking back at it now, I mean, a lot of people said, well, you know, King Biscuit, you know, it's out of bootleg. I said, so what? This is better than any bootleg. You had Glenn Johns in there remixing it, you know, and people go, oh, well, you know, I have that for years and years. And I said, well, I didn't have that quality for years and years.
No,
my quality on my tape.